and welcome into the Pro Football Weekly Podcast. Hope you are having a good week and getting ready for an exciting round of playoff action in the divisional round, unlike what we saw wild card weekend. A lot of snoozers by the second half of that one, but I feel confident in saying that we should have some better action to look forward to this weekend. I, of course, am your host, Arthur Arkish, and pleased, as always, that you're back with us on the Pro Football Weekly Podcast. I am excited to welcome in Pro Football Weekly contributor Ty Shalter to help me break down the entire weekend slate. Before I do that, I want to familiarize you with our great sponsor, Loot Crate. On a quest for epic gear, housewares, and collectibles, Loot Crate brings you between 4 to 6 of the coolest curated mystery items every month straight to your doorstep. It's the best surprise you know is coming. Our next crate's theme is Origins. We have awesome and exclusive items from your old school favorites. This January, see where it all started and explore the iconic Origins with historic items featuring Superman, Captain America, Mario, and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, including, as always, our monthly t-shirt and pin. You have until the 19th at 9 p.m. Pacific to subscribe and receive this month's crate, and when the cutoff happens, that's it, it's over. Make sure to head to www.lootcrate.com/Shaw and enter the promo code Shaw to save $3 off any new subscription today. One more time, that promo code Shaw, S-H-A-W, and we thank our great sponsor, Loot Crate. Alrighty, before I welcome in Ty, also just a quick reminder, as I do every time we tape a PFW podcast, to please head over to iTunes and subscribe to us while you're over there. We'd love it if you left us a rating and a comment, any type of review. All helps this PFW podcast gain traction. And one more sort of programming note before I welcome on Ty. I think I'm going to do a separate podcast this afternoon with Hub Arkish to get some Way We Hear It info. I know we didn't have one for you last week, so I'm going to do my best to double dip on the PFW podcast for the divisional round week. That way I'll be able to get his picks and also some news. Of course, the Chargers moving to Los Angeles. We've had 3 head coaching openings filled now in Jacksonville, Buffalo, and Denver. And we always like to kind of pick Hub's brain and see what he's hearing on all the week's most pressing topics. So without further ado, Ty Shalter breaking down the divisional round action with me.
How's everything going? Since we last talked, I believe I owe you a mazel tov. You added a new byline to your ever-expanding repertoire. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I just started contributing regularly to 538.com. So I've already got 4 articles up, another one coming this week. Should be 2 or 3 a week from here on out.
Terrific. That's great news. And if anyone doesn't know, they can find Taj Shalter, of course, at Pro Football Weekly and Vice Sports and The Comeback in addition to 538. That's definitely exciting news. And check out his work in all of those places, of course, starting with Pro Football Weekly.
Of course.
Ty, let's dive right into the weekend's action. We appreciate you taking some time. And I just thought we'd go game by game and kind of take a look at where things stand. Let me just ask very generally first, divisional round, a lot of people think is sometimes the best week of the playoffs. Do you expect that we're going to get a lot more competitive football after a real snooze fest last weekend?
Yeah, and you know, as I wrote for Vice, last weekend it was weird because really a lot of these games were very close through 3 quarters, and almost all of the final scores sort of flattered the favorites. Sure. Where they come out of, you know, oh, 4 blowouts, oh, straight chalk, everything, you know, all 4 favorites covered the spread by more than a touchdown. Wow. Yep. But there's a lot of tight back and forth, and they go into this next round, the divisional round. You know, if you're thinking that Green Bay or Seattle is unbeatable because of what they did last week, you know, not so much. Again, you look at these matchups now, some fantastic matchups, some very strong, you know, number 1 and number 2 seed. It's hosting some teams that have got big wins under their belt, but I think they're all going to be very close, all going to be very competitive.
Yeah, I hope you're right, and I do tend to agree, and we'll talk about maybe the lone exception. Obviously, the Texans going to Foxborough. We'll get there in a minute, but I figure we'll just go in order, and that means starting with Seattle, heading out to Atlanta. It's a rematch, and of course, all 4 of these games will be rematches from the regular season, but Ty, I guess the question on my mind anyway is, what's a bigger factor for the Seahawks this time around that wasn't the case back in week 6? Will it be the absence of Earl Thomas, or the presence of definitely their top back in Thomas Rawls and maybe CJ Procise getting his way on the field as well.
Yeah, lots of questions about this. And of course, Atlanta went up to Seattle, played a great game.
Right.
And oh boy, you know, if you're a fan of referee conspiracy theories or crediting wins to the refs, certainly Atlanta had every chance to win that game there at the end. So this is a very close game of almost a functional tie between these two teams.
Right.
And as you say, they're without Earl Thomas. And really, Seattle, this is a team I look at and I go, I am not overwhelmed by them defensively or offensively. You can pick individual games and go, oh yeah, this Seahawks defense, so great. But they struggled to end the season against the terrible San Francisco 49ers.
Yep.
They struggled. They let up 34 points at home to Arizona, breaking their season-long undefeated streak at home. They beat up the Rams, but they got roasted by the Packers 38-10 back in, just a few weeks ago, December 11th. So I look at this and I go, I don't see the Seattle Seahawks as this invincible force. Mm-hmm. And, the Detroit Lions played not that impressive an offensive game, missed a lot of opportunities, shot themselves in the foot. And Seattle needed a couple of miracle catches from Paul Richardson there to get this win. So I look at this matchup against Atlanta and I go, can Seattle put up enough points? Because I don't think that Seattle can go into Atlanta, put the clamps on, and hold them under 20, let alone under 10 like they did the Lions last week.
Right, and obviously, they weren't able to last time, 26-24 final, and,
yeah.
And they had Richard Sherman following Julio Jones across the field, and it worked in the first half, but boy, Julio got loose and really ignited that late rally for Atlanta that almost turned the tide there. So, the numbers are staggering without Earl Thomas and the way that teams have had, some success attacking the middle of the field deep. I didn't think the Lions were able to do that last week. Like you said, it was largely because they just couldn't hold on to the football. But that's the thing about Atlanta, and kind of goes with what you just said. They've been scoring like crazy, and they've been scoring in different ways. Anyone who thinks that it's just Matt Ryan and Julio Jones doing that are mistaken.
Right, no.
So, Ryan's been spreading it around. Obviously, they are driving the ball vertically. But everyone knows about Julio, and that Julio Sherman matchup may be the best individual one all weekend. Who's the second guy you wonder who may be able to exploit a Deshaun Sheed or a Jeremy Lane or get on some of those linebackers a little bit?
Yeah, that's the great question. And, for me, it's Hardy. Actually, it's funny. I went, and this is one of the articles that I wrote for 538.com. If you go look at this, Justin Hardy was actually leading the league in DVOA for wide receivers, and Julio was number two.
Wow.
So you talk about per play value adjusted mm-hmm. for defense. When you throw it to Justin Hardy this season, you're getting more out of that pass than throwing it to any other wide receiver in the league. That's how
wow.
productive he's been as the number two for Atlanta, matching up against number two corners, matching up against slot corners, matching up against safeties, getting open deep. And I think Kyle Shanahan's done a tremendous job with his scheme, with his variations. He does a great job dictating matchups,
yes,
spreading it out, bunching it up,
yep.
shotgun, under center, off play action,
yep.
off zone runs. The big Justin Hardy catch, I went back and looked at their game against Arizona. You had Patrick Peterson one-on-one on Justin Hardy. And you break this play down. There's zone action to the right. Looks like a run to the right. There's play action off that. So Matt Ryan pulls up, pulls the ball, does a little half boot back to the left. So Justin Hardy's route, it's two moves. One goes two moves. One goes to the right,
mm-hmm.
and Peterson kind of follows him, but his eyes are in the backfield checking on the run action. And then with the half boot, Hardy cuts up field. Peterson keeps his eyes in the backfield. Then he starts backpedaling, and then Hardy makes the move back outside. Ryan lets it go. He's all by himself. There's no pressure on him. Passes a little high and behind, but even so, there's so much separation by the time Peterson realizes, oh no, he's going deep to my guy,
right.
and he's 3 yards behind me. Even Peterson doesn't have the speed to close down on Justin Hardy. Hardy makes a great catch. And I'm like, this is how, if you're sitting here, you're Kyle Shanahan, and you're like, I've got Justin Hardy one-on-one with Patrick Peterson, and you're converting that for a 38-yard gain.
No kidding.
You are messing with people. You are breaking defenses with your scheme and with your plays. And so that's how he's getting these people in position to do the most damage. And Matt Ryan's been able to execute.
That's an awesome breakdown, Ty. And gosh, where does Taylor Gabriel fall on that list? Talk about a guy who has been efficient with his explosive touchdowns when he touches it. He's got to be fairly high too, I would think.
Yeah, I think there's a limit. There's a cutoff, you know, for DVOA, for a number of targets or whatever it is. Yeah, but Mohamed Sanu is 34th.
Okay.
So when I wrote that article, so I'm like, okay, so if you've got your top three receivers, if you're going 32 teams, you basically have all three of your receivers are producing like number one receivers in terms of DVOA. And that's how, you know, the execution's been incredible. And really, you know, Matt Ryan, like his play hasn't been that much better. You know, he's cut out some of the interceptions, some of the dumb mistakes, cut out some of the pressing, but he hasn't been like pinpoint laser accuracy. You know, he's not out there like 2001 Kurt Warner threading needles and, you know, never letting the ball touch the ground.
Sure.
But he's finding the right guy. He's getting it there and his receivers are playing great. Of course, defenses cannot ignore the run game that they've got with Freeman and Coleman. So they can beat you pretty much any way they want to beat you right now. And if you're Seattle and you don't have Earl Thomas and you can't contain on the back end, there's a lot of different ways that Matt Ryan and Kyle Shanahan can and will beat you. And that's why I come back to, can Russell Wilson and that offense score enough points on the Falcons defense, which isn't great, but it hasn't had to be in order to keep pace.
Yeah, that's amazing stuff, Ty, and pretty interesting to think that now suddenly half the head coaching vacancies are filled and Kyle Shanahan still sitting out there, thought by many to be the leading candidate entering the offseason. So it'll be fun to see how that situation unfolds. Let's just spend a minute, Ty, talking quickly about what that Atlanta defense will be looking at in Thomas Rawls and Russell Wilson. Everyone knows Seattle's offensive line is an issue. The Lions kind of exploited it last week with Anson Fant, not as much as I expected them to. What do you think? I guess, A, they'd have to be able to stop Thomas Rawls, and that's a task in and of itself after what he did last week. But what do you look at in that matchup, the Seattle offense and Atlanta defense, and maybe who that favors?
Yeah, great question. And of course, you look at what they did, and they were able to play their game, you know, play the Tom Cable game. They were able to go out there and win at the point of attack and win one-on-ones and open up lanes for Rawls. And even though they didn't really keep Russell Wilson clean, they were able to control the pace of the game, keep the score, keep the points low, keep the ball out of Matthew Stafford's hands, and just really could block between the 20s. Put them in position at the end of both halves in order to score. So, you know, that's, you know, almost beating the Lions at their own game in that sense, by using the run to control the ball instead of the short passing game. But then you look at how they match against Atlanta. You know, Atlanta does not have a great run defense. They're not physically overwhelming at the point of attack. You know, the defensive line, that's all about penetration. It's all about aggression. And it's all about getting a sack, getting a turnover, a drive, and giving Matt Ryan and that offense one or two or three more possessions than the other way around. You know, teams are not running often on that. I'm sorry, other way around. Teams are running a lot. It's their fifth. Their fifth in rushing attempts against, which means teams are not running against them. Whew. Okay, sorry, my fact checker, my editor. Kind of thing that I'd put in an article, and then a copy editor would be like, wait a minute, you said they did, and I'm like, no, I got myself backwards, but I'm looking at my notes here. They are fifth in rushing attempts, so people are not running against the Falcons because they are playing catch up. You know, they're behind. So how often is Thomas Rawls, how many reps are they going to be able to get him if Matt Ryan and the Falcons are doing what Matt Ryan and the Falcons do?
Let's move to the biggest mismatch on paper of the weekend. Ty, what can the Texans do just to keep it to under 15.5 points going into Foxborough?
I'm glad you referenced the line, because I had to pick for the hot read at ProFootballWeekly.com, and I was like, look, you know, there is no way that I'm laying 14.5, 15.5, whatever it was. I'm not laying that many points in a cold weather outdoor NFL playoff game. That having been said, you know, you look at this game, it's very hard to see how, you know, Houston keeps it close. Obviously, the last time they met, 27-0 blowout with Jacoby Brissett at the helm. Tom Brady takes back over. Of course, you don't have any Rob Gronkowski. You know, you're relying on some guys, you know, Malcolm Mitchell, Chris Hogan, that you weren't really relying on before when these two teams met.
Right.
But even by that same token, you know, there's nothing better or different about the Texans' offense. Brock Osweiler's been benched and brought back since then. Texas defense is certainly playing better. Jadeveon Clowney has stepped up his game tremendously Merciless is playing very well. The secondary is great. So they're going to keep it close. And I like, you know, I like the under, and I think the under opened 46 and it's moved down to 44.5. So a lot of people like the under. And I can see this one staying close through three quarters or so, and maybe even Houston covering. But they just don't have the firepower. There's no way. This is the number one scoring defense in the NFL. The Texans have not been able to move the ball or score with any regularity. And Brock Osweiler playing the we'll just keep it close and then I just need to make one play game is not going to work against the Patriots in Gillette in winter in the playoffs. It's just not happening.
Yeah, I'm totally with you on that. I am curious to get your take, though. Have you seen an improved Brock Osweiler since he was benched? He has his first consecutive game NFL streak of not turning the ball over. And granted, when you're averaging about 5.5 yards per attempt, that's maybe not a huge achievement. But I am wondering if you've seen, does it look like maybe he's learned a little bit from his benching to where he can just keep the Texans in the game? It's easy to forget it was actually the Texans special teams in the first matchup that committed two turnovers, I believe, that gave Jacoby Brissett in the Patriots short fields in order to kind of make this one ugly in a hurry.
Yeah, you know, I'm seeing a little bit of improvement, but I think this is partly just Bill O'Brien coming to grips with the player that this quarterback is, understanding what he can ask Brock Osweiler to do, understanding that he can't ask Brock Osweiler to do things that he's not great at in situations where it's not ideal. Right. You know, that you go, okay, well, unless we are behind and are playing catch up, we can't just have you chuck down long balls to Nuke Hopkins and Will Fuller. Like, that's not going to be the way that we win football games, because you're not accurate enough, you're not winning that play, that route often enough. So, you know, I think both parties, the quarterback and the coach, are more comfortable with each other and what their limitations are and what their strengths are, and they're working together. It's funny because, you know, nationally we have this narrative of, oh, Brock is terrible. Oh, he got forced on Bill O'Brien. Oh, this was a Rick Smith move, and Bill O'Brien's just trying to, you know, make lemonade. And but it's funny, I talked to John McClain, the great reporter for the Houston Chronicle, on SiriusXM last weekend, and he said that is the opinion of nincompoops who don't know anything about how football works in Houston.
That's a John McClain word. He used that word, didn't he?
Yes, he did. That is a direct quote. Okay. I quote nincompoops, yep, who, and I quote, don't know anything about how it works down here in Houston. So that's, yeah. So, you know, obviously Bill O'Brien liked Brock Osweiler. He was the best fit for what they had at the time, and they've got stability and they understand going forward, this is the guy. And I brought up to him, I really like to see in the season finale, Savage goes down, Osweiler goes back in there, he scores that rushing touchdown, mm-hmm, and the way you see his offensive linemen jump up and run to him, and everybody jumps around Brock, they're patting his head and shoulders, yeah, they're jumping up and down, they're so excited, right, for Brock that he got back in, that he scored that touchdown, that he helped them secure the division, secure the playoffs, and I went, wow. You know, there are a lot of nominated, anointed, chosen one quarterbacks that never won the team to their side, that were handed the job in training camp, that are getting this, that are starters just because they're the ones that are getting paid. This is not that situation. This team believes in him, and as McClain told me, they've seen him come in at 5:30 every morning and be the last to leave. They've seen him, they've seen how hard he's worked all year to get to the point he's at and improve himself to where they can win games with him and slightly because of him even. That all having been said, you know, that's great for next year. It was funny because I said it seems like Houston is so happy for next year because they won this game, mm-hmm, but you know, the season's not over. And he just laughed and said, cattle to the slaughter. And at the time we, you know, at the live, we still hadn't seen the Miami Pittsburgh game yet. So I'm like, so either way, like, he's like, yeah, either way, but especially if they're going to New England, no hope, absolutely none. They're cattle to the slaughter. It's all over, but they have a lot to be excited about for next season.
It's interesting. You know, he seems like an easy enough guy to root for. I mean, his game isn't likable, but he seems like a likable guy. I thought that was such a classy tweet he fired off when Gary Kubiak retired. And
yes,
I think he's by and large said all the right things about what was a pretty awkward departure. So it doesn't change the fact, like you said, this is just a mammoth mismatch on paper. One more quick, let's just talk Patriots real quick and we'll move on, Ty.
Sure.
I guess just your thoughts on maybe two of the newer guys who have emerged, and Michael Floyd and Deion Lewis. LeGarrette Blount missed practice for a second straight day, and certainly we saw, if you're talking about kind of teammates seemingly rallying behind a guy, watching what Michael Floyd did in week 17 with his effort, I thought was pretty cool too.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's Michael Floyd. We get in this situation of, how hard do you root for a guy who has the opportunity that he has because what he did at the DUI? But even so, anytime you see a guy play the game that hard and understand the opportunity that he's been given coming out of Arizona, where, he was a big part of what they were doing and what they planned to do. Now he goes to New England and has this chance.
Yep.
He's trying to make the most of it. He obviously loves doing what he's doing. He's immediately become a big part of what the Patriots do, and I think the Patriots understood he filled a giant hole in their roster in terms of size and speed and downfield physicality and verticality. They just did not have that. So that's a big part of it, certainly. And I just, again, marvel at the coaching job Bill Belichick has done this year. And, you look at how they've gotten production out of these role players. This is a team that intentionally twice dealt away key members of their front seven, that intentionally got cheaper and in a lot of cases older. You give up Chandler Jones and pick up Chris Long.
Yep.
You sign these, the moves that you made were moves that made you less good. And then they turn around and, they pick up Kyle Van Noy and suddenly, unlock some of his playmaking ability that the Lions saw at BYU years ago. All of these moves, and they've all kind of worked in his favor. And yeah, I think I've been trying to say all along, this is a flawed team. This isn't as strong a team as we saw 2 years ago. Tom Brady is playing very well given the cast that he's got, but it's not quite as lights out as it was at his best. And, he didn't need to be that hot when he came back and they played a pretty soft schedule. He was mostly just, throwing it to Gronk and letting Gronk run wild. Right. And that hasn't been the case, obviously, the past few weeks. But, I've seen flaws in the Patriots. There have been holes in their game. And they've coached and played and executed it. And a couple of times, like Chris Hogan getting a busted coverage against Baltimore, they've lucked their way around these limitations. And right now, you cannot argue with the results. You cannot argue with the bottom line. And this may be Bill Belichick's best coaching job ever. And that is obviously saying something.
Yeah, Matt Elam still killing the Ravens. For our listeners who may not know, I just want to quickly remind everyone that Ty grew up watching the Lions. I grew up watching the Bears. So if you're wondering, if you're tired of the Belichick marveling, well, they've gotten something out of Kyle Van Noy and Shea McClellan, so you can understand where we're coming from with all of this. Right. But I said
on Twitter after the news of the trade came through, you can almost picture the coordinators with Bill Belichick, like Matt Patricia calls up Bill Belichick and is like, okay, if I can make a solid contributor out of Kyle Van Noy, what'll you give me? They bet like a handle of bourbon or something on it. Like, okay, if he's in the lineup at Christmas, I'll send you a six of your favorite or something like that. All right, cool. I'll make the trade. That's you wonder almost on a dare. They're just trying to turn the degree of difficulty up for themselves just to see if they can do it.
Yeah, they just like to prove that they're smarter than everyone else. And
exactly.
Look, it's a player's league, but there's nothing wrong with marveling the job that these guys are doing. It has been remarkable.
For sure.
It'll be interesting to see if McDaniels and or Patricia moves on in the offseason. Ty, we're halfway through our preview. In my opinion, the most interesting game of the weekend up next, the Steelers going into Arrowhead. And actually, I think it was the most lopsided affair in the regular season edition. But a lot has changed since then. I guess I have to start here. Are you buying, are you concerned at all, I should say, about Roethlisberger's right ankle, foot, lower leg, or do you think it's much ado about nothing? And, you know, I think the Steelers are used to that other distraction of Joey Porter making an ass of himself, but how do they deal, how do they deal with this divisional round week getting off on a little bit of a distracting note?
Yeah, and this is the big advantage Pittsburgh has over Kansas City, which is that all these players, for the most part, the core players, the nucleus, have been here before. They understand what the playoffs are about. They understand what they need to do. They have one, two, three, however many rings they have.
Yep.
Organizationally, they know what to do. Mike Tomlin knows what to do. And so, you know, Ben Roethlisberger's played through pain plenty of times. My big concern is a couple of dumb picks Roethlisberger threw in the Miami game, and at least one more that definitely should have been picked off, although it was on the same drive as one of the other picks, so I don't know if we can double count it, but the point being, yep. Ben Roethlisberger has not covered himself in glory over the past few weeks. Not that he's played poorly.
No, you're right. You're right.
Le'Veon Bell has been the driving force for this team. The defense has been excellent. And, you know, it's almost the polar opposite of the Steelers team we saw. The first half of the season, the Steelers team was a Lamborghini that kept breaking down. They were either going to score 38 or they're going to score 3. And you didn't know which one was going to show up. Now they're basically beating everybody by a field goal on the strength of the running game and the defense. Yep. And part of that is injuries and suspensions to the wide receivers. You know, I actually wrote in this week's hot read for Pro Football Weekly, you know, this is a team we come into this going, or, you know, we come into just before the Martavis Bryant suspension. We're like, all right, the Steelers are rolling 5 deep in terms of big name, big time, big tool receivers. Nobody has the depth at that position that the receivers have. What an incredible strength. And we're sitting here and it's like, okay, we've still got Antonio Brown, and then Eli Rogers, Kobe Hamilton. Kobe Hamilton. Like, why is Kobe Hamilton catching the game-winning touchdown pass in the last game of the regular season for a team that had like 5, if not former first rounders, then first round caliber players at the start of the season at that position. So, you know, they've changed things around. And Ben Roethlisberger, you know, you can beat the Miami Dolphins with an off day from Ben, a couple of turnovers. I don't know that you can beat the Chiefs at Arrowhead that way. All the numbers, you know, like a DVOA, yards per play, all that sort of thing indicate the Steelers and Chiefs are very similar teams, but Pittsburgh's just a little bit better all the way around. The big questions then become, except on special teams, Tyreek Hill, better, you know, they've had a little bit better results in the kicking, and then that Arrowhead Stadium home field advantage. Yep. It's cold, it's loud, it's everything that you want a playoff environment to be, and this is a fan base that should expect results. And I'm very curious to see how this plays out. I'm curious to see Andy Reid with so much time to prepare for Pittsburgh. I feel like this is a legacy game for him. I said so in the hot read for Pro Football Weekly, and I said, you know, he has not made it out of the divisional round since 2008. He hasn't, that was the first time and only time since 2004.
Wow.
And this is a guy who is the second winningest head coach with a job right now behind Bill Belichick. You know, he's had, this is his third double-digit win Chiefs team in 4 years. His only playoff win was that thrashing of the Houston Texans last year when they were just lucky to be there. Mm-hmm. The Texans were, obviously. And the Chiefs, this team, should be playing for AFC championships, maybe NFL championships. And if they go down to the Steelers without even a great game from Roethlisberger, without even a you know, awesome performance or overcoming of obstacles or whatever from the Steelers, if this is a 16-14 nondescript Steelers win, you have to look at Andy Reid and go, where are you at? Because you've got one of the best rosters in the NFL. You had the home field advantage. You had everything going your way. You won the division. You've got to be able to bring it in the playoffs.
Yeah, that's a great point, Ty. You know, I think Mike Tomlin is probably, you know, just generally the more scrutinized head coach, but he's got a pair of Super Bowl rings. Those are pretty decent aces in the hole. So no legacy game here for him, even though some people think maybe he has underachieved at times with what he's had to work with. But no, that's an excellent point. And let's just talk for a minute about Tyreek Hill and what they've been doing with him, Brad Childress and Andy Reid, and maybe who the Steelers have to counter him with, because it looks like he and Travis Kelce have become kind of, or I guess Kelce and Hill have become 1A and 1B as Macklin has sort of gotten lost in the shuffle. I mean, that's a pretty dangerous guy to have sort of lost in the shuffle. But how do you think the Steelers look to attack those two red-hot Chiefs skill players?
Yeah, and obviously, yeah, Hill's doing as much damage in special teams as in the offense, but he's doing the damage on the offense too. Yeah. This is not an overwhelming Steelers secondary. Of course, the corners have never been the strength of that defense. They're very young, and there's a ton of speed and a ton of skill now too in that offense. So the limiting factor again becomes Alex Smith's confidence. My co-host on SiriusXM's NFL Inside Read, Jason Cole, always says he doesn't have the arm, he doesn't have the arm, he doesn't have the arm. And he doesn't have the arm to dominate deep repeatedly, but he's got the arm to get the ball downfield. The question has always been, is Andy Reid drawing it up? And does he have the confidence to pull the trigger? So protection becomes a big issue, which means schematically, I think the Steelers are going to have to continue to get creative with blitzes. They're going to have to bring pressure from weird places. I think they have to unsettle Alex Smith and make him feel like he cannot go downfield because he doesn't have the time, doesn't have the protection, his guys aren't open enough, whatever. Because when Alex Smith has confidence and makes those throws downfield, we know those guys can run under it. We know those players are downfield, that they can get vertical. It's Chris Conley, Tyreek Hill, Macklin, whoever it is, they've got players downfield. So, again, I think it becomes making sure that Alex Smith gets rattled early and often and try and force him into playing in a phone booth and that way beat himself.
And that's an underrated element, Ty, of what the Steelers have done lately, their pass rush. Everyone knows about Brown and Bell and Ben, who actually has struggled a little bit, but the Steelers' pass rush has really heated up. They did it last week with James Harrison, the 80-year-old outside linebacker who somehow is still the best best defender on that. He might have been the best defender on the field during Wild Card Weekend. It was pretty remarkable stuff. But tough matchups in Eric Fisher and Mitchell Schwartz, of course. The Chiefs have pretty good bookends, so that'll be fun to watch. I'm going to get your picks at the end, Ty, just on the way out, but we have one more game to look at. It should be another dandy, and maybe the one I've went back and forth on as much as any. I know you have written two articles in particular about Jordy Nelson in the past couple weeks, so why don't we start there and what it will take for Green Bay to overcome what we assume will certainly be the absence of Jordy Nelson with the ribs injury.
Yeah, and this is tough because when I wrote that Jordy Nelson's getting his explosion back in that knee, getting his speed back, getting open and getting separation, you could see it on the field. It wasn't there over the first half of the season. It wasn't there for the most part when they played the Cowboys at home in week 6 and the Cowboys basically stomped him out. But shortly after that, Nelson started getting open. He started getting matchup. He started dictating coverage. That got some of these other Green Bay receivers open. And, you know, Aaron Rodgers, who's had to run around and make time and pat the ball and duck and bob and weave, even with outstanding pass protection all season long, his receivers have just taken forever and ever and ever to get open. Now they're getting open, giving him options. He's able to execute. The offense explodes. Okay, great. They're rolling through everybody. And then they play the Giants, and it's the same situation. The Giants have a great defense, great secondary, and nobody's open. Nobody's open. Aaron Rodgers just pulling incredible miracles out of thin air, getting two touchdowns late in the first half. Jordy Nelson goes out just before then, but without those two touchdowns, you know, first off, they got a short field on a short punt. And he made that incredible play to Devontae Adams where he was dancing around for 8.5 seconds, just dodging defensive linemen and keeping it low. And then the Hail Mary, you know. And so I post this article. So, okay, now without Jordy Nelson, we go back to where we were, which is I don't know that the Packers have enough people who can get open against the Cowboys defense, at least not fast enough. And then I don't think that the Packers match up any better against Dak Prescott, Zeke Elliott, and that offensive line now than they did a couple months ago. Right. And people started losing their minds. Well, didn't you just see Aaron Rodgers shred the Giants? Yeah, he didn't really shred the Giants. You know, I don't
for
think
for a quarter, maybe. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. For a quarter, late, Yes. And yes, Randall Cobb coming up out of nowhere, having his first real great game all season. Is that repeatable? You know, is a Hail, and I understand he's connected on two Hail Marys this year and a third over the past two seasons. But how many Hail Marys is Aaron Rodgers going to hang on the Dallas Cowboys? Right. I don't think that you can go into there and go, oh, yeah, cool. He'll hang one or two Hail Marys on the Cowboys. Randall Cobb will have a three-touchdown game again. And you know, this will all be the same going forward. So, and again, the Cowboys, this defense certainly, and I, you know, see to the point on Twitter as many people came at me. No, the Cowboys, talent for talent, position for position, production for production, not as good a defense as the New York Giants. Absolutely not. But they're only allowing 1.3 more points per game because the Cowboys' offense is much better and controls the ball and denies possessions. And Aaron Rodgers isn't going to get as many bites at the apple against the Cowboys as he did against the Giants. So for me, the Packers, as hot as they are, as good as they are, without Jordy Nelson, they are still decided underdogs against Dallas. And the wise guys see it that way, too. And the money keeps pushing the line further towards the Cowboys. I definitely see this, especially with the home field advantage, the environment. This is a game I expect the Cowboys to win. And I know you wanted me to hold off the picks to the end.
No, it's okay. That's all right.
But that having been said, if the line continues to be in that 4.5-5 point area, I still don't think Aaron Rodgers takes a 5, 6, 7, 8 point L in this game without putting up a serious fight. And I don't think Dak Prescott and company, as many points as they might put on the defense, are going to be able to shut Rodgers out quite to that extent. So I see it very likely that the Cowboys win, but the Packers have a very good shot to cover.
Ty, it's kind of funny because we were talking about the Steelers wide receivers and how replacing Martavis Bryant hasn't proved to be quite as easy as many expected with that great depth. To me, it sounds like the Packers last year, after losing Jordy Nelson, everyone said, okay, Davante Adams is growing up overnight and Randall Cobb is so good and they may have another weapons and enough other weapons, and it didn't really happen. It obviously, they've come together with Jordy this season, and we saw them manage to keep it together after Jordy went down last week, but I find that parallel kind of interesting. And I have to add, you wonder what maybe happens without those two divine intervention touchdowns before halftime. What happens if the Giants don't lose Dominique Rodgers-Cromartie in that game? Because he was such a big part very early on of the coverage sacks Rodgers was taking and all the issues that were happening. So that may have turned that one too, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And Cobb, you know, it's worth saying that he has a sort of specific role in the Packers offense. When everybody is healthy, he does what he does, and he's healthy, I should add. That was one thing Rodgers was talking about, that he hasn't been quite right all year. When he can bring that explosion out of the slot, that inside to outside move, and can beat people deep, can split safeties, then Rodgers can really hit him and help him shred defenses that way. But you put Cobb out on the outside and go, you're our number one. He's never been able to be that guy. Whenever Nelson's gone down, been hurt, whatever it is, they've slid him over to one, and it's never worked out. He's never been able to play that role. He's never been able to get separation. And Davante Adams obviously has a little bit more of the frame, and that's a little bit more of his game, but he also hasn't been consistent either in getting open or in catching the ball when he is. There are some games when Adams looks great and you go, oh wow, okay, here it is, the future is here, Rodgers to Adams, and then there are other games you go, man, this kid cannot catch the football. This guy cannot get open the way Nelson does. And so Nelson still has a skill set that no other Packers receiver has. I love Geronimo Allison. I love him as this guy that can run that nine route and challenge defenses and can help create a little space when Nelson isn't there. But it feels like all the other pieces have to be in place and clicking for Allison to, not dominate, but for Allison to really stretch and provide what he can provide for the Packers offense. So that becomes the question. Can Randall Cobb step up? They're not going to have Jared Cook, I believe. Last I saw, that's another piece of the puzzle. That's another guy that Rodgers leans on sometimes, that he won't be there. So that running game is going to have to be in place. I hadn't seen an update on Ty Montgomery either, as effective as he's been out of the backfield. Can you go into AT&T Stadium and be like, all right, we need to run Kristen Michael to win? Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think that's a recipe they're hoping to have to lean on, but lots of good stuff there. And I was going to kind of tease our listeners to head over to check out your hot read. There's some more good stuff on Geronimo Allison and how he could potentially be a factor like he was in Week 17, actually doing some work out of the slot for the Packers. He has been impressive as an undrafted rookie. Ty, just one quick Cowboys question. I'm sorry, I know I've kept you too long, but I'd be remiss if we did this preview and I didn't ask Dak and Zeke, their first ever playoff game. They shredded the Packers back in Week 5, Week 6, whatever it was. The Packers' best defender last week may have been Julius Peppers, but he's not really a rundown guy. So you're probably looking at Clay Matthews and Nick Perry and Dayton Jones trying to guard the perimeter. Do you have any reason to believe that Dak and Zeke won't continue rolling like they have been all rookie year?
No, and I'll tell you why. You talk about the pressure that you put on the Green Bay Packers safeties in this situation, because the question becomes, you're probably not going to stop Zeke with your front seven. You've got to bring a safety into it. You've got to keep defensive backs over the top in a stack. You've got to keep them fixed.
Yep.
Which means that you can attack them. If you know where those safeties are going to be, even if you know they're going to be in the box, or even if you know they're going to be in a cover two, if they have to stay behind the front seven in order to avoid that, you know, patented Zeke Elliott hit the hole 5 yards downfield, make one guy miss, and it's off to the races. You know, if you have to have at least one safety floating back there, then you know where they're going to be, and you can attack the space, and you can attack the zones, and Dak Prescott's going to be able to make those throws. So I think the pressure it puts on the Packers' safeties is what's going to be the issue that keeps the Packers from committing to the run, stopping Zeke, and slowing the whole thing down, because Dak's going to be able to beat them.
Yeah, it's a great call, because the Packers essentially beat the Giants, the Packers defensively last week with like six guys in the box and Jake Ryan playing the game of his life, and there's no question Dom Capers will need a slightly different approach this time. All right, Ty, so much awesome stuff, and we're so appreciative, but I won't let you get out of here without just quick picks. You've already broke down the games to a T, but who do you like in the other three games? Let's go back to Atlanta, and I think the home Falcons are getting like 2 points or something like that.
Yeah, I like Atlanta in this game. I do think they're going to be able to put a lot of points on the Seahawks defense, just like the Packers hung 38 on them a few weeks ago. I don't think Seattle can keep up, so I like Atlanta in that one for sure.
Okay, and I was wrong. They're actually they are giving 5 points. So it's a little bigger spread than I thought, but I like the Falcons too. Let's not even worry about the spreads. We'll just pick winners and losers.
Sure.
Texans, Patriots. I already have the answer on that. What about Andy Reid and his legacy game at Arrowhead? What do you think about the visiting Steelers coming in?
I think it's really, really, really close, but the combination of Tyreek Hill being able to score a touchdown from any point on the field at any time, the Kansas City's home field advantage, the extra time Andy Reid had to prepare, and the fact that Ben Roethlisberger has not looked like a difference maker over the past few weeks. Obviously, I understand his resume and I understand what he's done on the field, but we are not getting Ben Roethlisberger at his best right now, and that we may need something close to it for the Steelers to go into Arrowhead and win. So I actually like the Chiefs in this game.
All right, great stuff. So the only difference in opinion we have, I'm taking the Steelers. There's supposed to be a ton of weather, and the hottest player on the field will be Le'Veon Bell, and I think he could ultimately be the biggest difference maker against the Chiefs' run defense that hasn't been great. But we're in lockstep on the other three, and Ty, that was such awesome stuff. I know you've got a busy schedule. I'll let you loose, but enjoy the games this weekend, and I'll try and get you back on if you're down in a couple weeks to do it again, because I always have a lot of fun having you on the Pro Football Weekly podcast.
Absolutely. Likewise, Arthur. Anytime.
All right. That is Ty Shalter. You can find his work at Vice Sports, at 538, at, of course, ProFootballWeekly.com. The comeback all over the place. So go check him out. Ty Shalter, great as always.
And I know I kept Ty too long. Hopefully he will forgive me. If he didn't have so much good information, I wouldn't have to keep him longer than I tell him he will be on the show for. So we thank Ty one more time. And if you're not checking out his weekly hot read column at ProFootballWeekly.com, well, you're doing it wrong. But there's always time to make a correction. Head over there now. Check out his divisional round column. Check out all our great work at ProFootballWeekly.com. We are up to speed and breaking down everything we're hearing and seeing and reporting on all the various off-season topics over at ProFootballWeekly.com. One more thank you as well to our great sponsor, Loot Crate. And the biggest thank you of all is to you, the listeners. We are so appreciative that you are with us each week, or almost each week. And We hope that you like what you're hearing. If you do, head over to iTunes, make sure you subscribe, and leave us a rating and a comment while you're over there. That is going to do it for installment one of this week's Pro Football Weekly podcast. Thank you again for being with us. I hope you enjoy the weekend's action, and I look forward to being back with you next week on the PFW podcast. Have a good one.